NorthAmerican.edu.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota, Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie.
And I'm Arlene Engelhardt. And we're hoping you'll be with us for the next hour and just keep your dial set to WMNF. We have some wonderful people in the studio today, and we're going to have an interesting discussion. So, Mary, you want to introduce them?
Yes, and I hope I thought to put their microphones on. I'm very excited. With us in the studio is Lisa Perry, an activist extraordinaire. Actually, last year she was in charge, or 2 years ago, the Women's March here in actually Pinellas, and she's been involved in an awful lot of things. It seems that when something's really happening, I'll see Lisa Perry, or I will also see on also a local level different kind of activity. But Tanya Vidovich, the firefighter extraordinaire, who sued the city of Tampa and won her lawsuit and was reinstated, and we are real curious to know what her life is like now back in the old fire station. And Tanya, I think, is one of the most active persons. I've never seen anyone that has so many hands and so many and not just organizations, but for your community. You're organizing always something, you know, for the kids, for the schools. Frankly, you must be like the Energizer Bunny. I've decided that you just have endless energy in it. And it's all to the good. So I'm really excited because, to me, this is a really pivotal time, really, in our country. We all know that. But I think it's particularly important for women right now. You know, what Tanya put up with discrimination. And really, as I say, we want to catch up what's happening with her life right now because we realize that one of the reasons that sexual harassment at work and so many places is unreported is because there is so much retaliation. And the retaliation can go on in a lot of different places. And we're also watching right now. The government is shut down. And, you know, real people are hurting. Real people need their paychecks. And they don't have trust funds that they can go to try and tide them over to pay the rent, to pay the groceries. And I am watching with absolute interest how everybody is reacting to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so before we get into everything we're going to be getting into... Rachel Maddow did a really good brief interview with Alexandria, and I thought she really had a chance to say it like it is. And to me, where all of us are here, and, you know, we're thinking of the Women's March, and we're thinking of individual work situations, you know, for women to really be able to fulfill their potential and really be involved. How do we get to the level where we really support a person like Alexandria or Elizabeth Warren or, you know, Tarana Burke, who's coming very shortly to our area, USF, to speak. But I thought kind of to set the tone, let's listen to Rachel and actually Alexandria, because she takes on the immigrant issue, which supposedly is what has shut this government down. Let's give a listen.
The amount of dysfunction that this president is advancing. We now have over 100 new members of this freshman class. I cannot even get laptops to my caseworkers on the ground in the Bronx and Queens so they can process the needs of our constituents. We can't get mortgage we cannot get their casework started because we can't even get laptops in the hands of our district offices because the president has decided to hold the paychecks of everyday Americans hostage so that he can fulfill a campaign, I don't even want to call it a promise, a campaign fantasy that the vast majority of Americans disapprove of. And not only that, but in the actual address, there was falsehood after falsehood, and we have to make sure that we get our facts straight. Everyday immigrants commit crimes at a far lower rate than native-born Americans. And not only that, but the women and children on that border that are trying to seek refuge and seek opportunity in the United States of America with nothing but the shirt on their backs are acting more American than any person who seeks to keep them out ever will be.
Are you at all dissuaded, not dissuaded, I guess is the wrong word, dismayed or discouraged by the fact that the president has been saying the same untrue things about immigrant crime, about the terrible character of immigrants coming into this country, about a false relationship that he has invented between violent crime and immigration. We heard him tell blatant falsehoods tonight, contradicted even by his own administration, about this flood, as he described it, a pipeline of drugs coming across the southern border. His own Drug Enforcement Administration has said that the vast majority of drugs, even those coming from the south from this country, are coming through ports of entry and not over anything that would be stopped by a wall. Are you discouraged, or what's your sort of strategic take on the fact that the president's been telling these same lies for years now and not shying away from them at all?
Well, I think it's unsurprising, because even before he was elected president of the United States, he has a proven track record of discrimination against anybody who's really non-white in the United States. He had been sued by the Nixon administration back in the day for not renting to black Americans. He has had controversy after controversy. So this is very consistent. It's not just the continued lies throughout his administration, but frankly, it's part of a very consistent pattern of his entire life. But I think it's extremely important. You know, I represent New York's 14th congressional district. We are 50% immigrant. I represent the Bronx and Queens, Jackson Heights. Over 200 languages are spoken in my district alone. We enjoy some of the highest rates of economic activity, and the Bronx itself has had some of the highest rates of economic growth in all of New York City, and that has been directly correlated with our embrace of immigrants. New York City overall is an immigrant city, and we enjoy a very large amount of economic and cultural prosperity as a result.
The president has been singing the same song that he did a different version of tonight in the Oval Office. Since the very, very start of his campaign, he has made anti-immigrant rhetoric and often factually incorrect screeds demonizing immigrants more core to his presidency than any other form of his rhetoric. And so in your district, in a district, as you say, that is not just diverse, but is 50% immigrant, and that you can, and you're talking about this sort of economic relationship that you can see between immigrant economic activity and the overall performance of your district. What's the consequence of having somebody as president who's made this core to his message and to what he wants his presidency to mean? What is the harm that's caused by him talking this way and using this sort of platform the way he has, even when he can't get his policies passed?
I can tell you a very personal story. You know, as many people know, I was working in restaurants just a year ago. And when the president first assumed office with his racist and violent rhetoric, people started to send themselves home. And as we know, in restaurants, hospitality, every American eats, if you can, if you're lucky enough, we're able to eat three times a day. And that means that we interact with the people who prepare our food three times a day. When those people start to go home, local, or rather go back to the countries which they originated from, because many of them consider the United States their home, those places, they go into dysfunction. I remember one of our lead cooks brought himself back to Mexico because he was so scared of the president's rhetoric. We had an insane amount of dysfunction. We're talking about local restaurants, we're talking about local businesses, we're talking about shuttering neighborhoods, and we're talking about people feeling unsafe. And no one should feel unsafe in the United States of America. And that includes our amazing and beautiful and productive immigrant community. And moreover, the one thing that the president has not talked about is the fact that he has systematically engaged in the violation of international human rights borders on human rights on our border. He has separated children from their families. He talked about what happened the day after Christmas. On the day of Christmas, a child died in ICE custody. The president should not be asking for more money to an agency that has systematically violated human rights. The president should be really defending why we are funding such an agency at all. Because right now, what we are seeing is death. Right now, what we are seeing is the violation of human rights. These children and these families are being held in what are called hieleras, which are basically freezing boxes that no person should be maintained in for any amount of time, let alone the amount of time that they are being kept on. And moreover, even if you are anti-immigrant, in this country, the majority of immigrant overstays, the majority of the reason that people are undocumented is visa overstay. It's not because people are crossing a border illegally. It is because of visa overstay, which, mind you, he's talking about legal immigration. He's trying to restrict every form of legal immigration there is in the United States. Mm. He's fighting against family reunification. He's fighting against the diversity visa lottery. He's fighting against almost every way that people can actually legally enter this country, forcing them to become undocumented. And then he's trying to attack their undocumented status. This is systematic, it is wrong, and it is anti-American. And again, those women and children trying to come here with nothing but the shirts on their back to create an opportunity and to provide for this nation are acting more in an American tradition than this president is right now.
Wow. That is saying it like it is, and it takes courage. And really, you know, I'm thinking of Mitt Romney. Remember when he ran for president and he suggested the solution for the immigration problem is for people to self-deport. Just, you know, take yourself and go back home. And, you know, there you've got a young woman. Last year, she was in a restaurant, working in a restaurant as a waitress and also doing a second job tending bar. She's got a college degree. She's obviously quite smart. And yet she couldn't find the kind of job in her field that she really wanted. And that I feel right now we need that kind of frankness. We need that kind of giving truth to power and not being afraid to do it. And even though they're criticizing her dancing, her dress, the fact that, you know, she couldn't afford to rent a place to stay there until she got her first paycheck. Come on, we can all relate to that. And you know, Tanya, I'm thinking of you. And, you know, that I've read, and I don't know, but I'm assuming it's kind of true, that you used to work in retail. And then your husband wanted to get a more fulfilling job, so then you two, you know, supported him. So he became a nurse, a registered nurse. And is this true, that you were so impressed having a job that you really felt it was meaningful and you could really give something to a community, and you wanted something different, too? Is that actually how you got in to the firefighting business?
Well, sort of.
Oh, wait, let me put you on here. Sorry, there you go.
No, you're good. Well, that's kind of the story. I mean, I was in retail for a little bit. I actually installed hardwood floors for about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And I did everything from, you know, pumping gas in Massachusetts during college to dog walking to retail. And then I went to sell floors and whatnot. So I have done a little bit of everything. I sold flowers for farms. But yeah, I definitely, it was an awakening when I was selling things and I wasn't being able to give back to the community. So then my now husband decided to go to nursing school, and we did a lot of self-evaluation and decided that we wanted to be more active in our community, and we wanted our you know, we wanted to find jobs that allowed that. And when I learned about, you know, what firefighters did, it's not just, you know, running into burning buildings, it is that, but it's also more. And it's the fact of being there for somebody when they're having a bad day and being a community activist, like, that is a part of it for me. 100%. Like, I'm busy every single day. I am busy, but I'm doing things that I love and I'm trying to make my community better all the time.
And I also want to welcome into this discussion. Right now, we're kind of having a free-flowing discussion. Tess Martin, and Tess is with Speak Out Brevard. And I know she has worked very carefully with Lisa Perry on all kinds of projects. And so, Tess, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're trying to figure out, you know, because you and Lisa and Tanya also are very active, very hardworking in your community, and where we go from here. You know, Tarana Burke is coming very shortly to this area. She's going to be speaking at USF Tampa at the Marshall Center at 8 o'clock on January 22nd. And she's gotten very frustrated with the Me Too movement. And I'm curious to know, because both of you were so involved with the Women's March. And so, and I know that the plans are on foot, you know, for, and I think that's fine for Women's March is here again next Saturday, I believe, January 19th. And so, what do you see how we can be as outspoken, so to speak, and but not just necessarily outspoken, we don't have to be speaking on Congress or on television, to fight for what we believe in and to translate that into a pretty dysfunctional political process right now. So what are you seeing, and how are you going forward from the Women's March?
Well, for me, I know a lot of new activists, which is really what I was after the 2016 election, that first Women's March was powerful. And it felt like all this momentum had built and we were all in the same space and we were sharing this energy and everyone was, you know, trying to figure out the best way to kind of use that energy. And so for me, the first Women's March in 2017 was just a jumping off point into activism. I felt like I just dove in and just worked so hard over the next 2 years. And that's why Lisa and I, when we connected, it was like an instant click because she was coming from the same place. And so what is frustrating is when you get kind of stuck in the protest mode. You know, there's a time and place for protest, but there's also so much work that needs to be done kind of behind the scenes with, you know, getting involved in the political process. And I get it, it's sticky and it's nothing that I ever wanted to be involved with before, but I just don't see any other way around it. And so I think we still need to find a way to, you know, making your voice heard, number one, is very important and it's empowering. And so I know there are people who, you know, going to a march or a protest is very therapeutic. But how do you follow that with action? To me, the time of just doing things to do them is over. Like, it needs to be paired with concrete action. And I think that's kind of what a lot of people see when you have that momentum in it, but it's not being carried to the next, you know, it just plateaus. So I can see, you know, making people aware of the issue, if we're tying it back to like something like the Me Too movement, all that awareness, and now kind of how we push forward. You know, all of these women being elected into the House, we have a record number of women serving. That to me is fantastic because that representation matters, and we're starting to take down the systemic sexism and gender inequality by making sure that more women have a seat at the table. So it's kind of making the connection between what are we protesting about? How do we fix it? Like, not, you know, so that we don't have to protest when we have more of us kind of at the table. And that's really, you know, what my focus has been.
Yeah, and I'm curious. So you said you got involved in 2016. Why did you decide to get involved then? And why hadn't you been more involved earlier?
Well, it's really just, honestly, complacency. You know, I voted in every election. I felt that that was, you know, that was my civic duty, and that was how I was engaged. Politics didn't interest me that much. I mean, I was aware of what was going on. I kind of fell into the 2016 election cycle just watching it. I wasn't involved in any way, but just in the growing horror, you know, the just seeing how the numbers of the polling and what was going on, and just the responses from other Americans and voters. And I realized, wow, there are a lot of things that are really messed up in this country. And I, not that I didn't, wasn't aware of it before, but just, you know, your head's in the sand, you're living your everyday life, you're not really paying attention. And meanwhile, all of this is happening. And after, after the next day after the election, I just was numb. I couldn't believe it. I was scared for the future. You know, I'm a black woman and have a black daughter. And so for us, our gender, our race, like all of these things, I felt so vulnerable and I didn't know what to do. And the way that I processed that was, I have to get involved. Like, I don't even know how I'm going to get involved because I've never done anything before, but I just felt compelled to get involved. And I fell in with a group of folks who felt the same way. And we just moved forward from there. But I, you know, I will never disengage the way that I was before. I'm actually horrified by that level of complacency in my past. And, you know, I'm going to work for the rest of my life to make up for it.
Well, you know, And again, you're listening to WMNF Tampa, and we're having kind of a speak-out session, you might say. Speak out Brevard, speak out Hillsboro, speak out Pinellas. But, you know, there's, you know, quite obviously, the political situation, I think that's why the Elizabeth Warrens and Jackie Spears and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Representative Tlaib all are so important now, because they're actually having the courage, because they're coming like you did, Tess, and I know Lisa, and I know Tanya. You came from your living experience, and you realized, I think, finally at the bottom line, that if you don't do it, no one's going to do it. But we're also dealing with the personal level. And, you know, Tanya, you've been, what now, 10 years with the fire department, essentially, right?
Yeah, it's been a little bit over 10 years that I got hired.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of Jackie Spear, because unfortunately, on this show, we have covered so much of sexual harassment, whether it's on the workplace, whether it's in the schoolyard, and frankly, in the military. And then Arlene was involved with the whistleblowers. Arlene, was it? I can't remember how many years ago we were dealing with the firefighters, the women firefighters.
I think it was about 6 or 7 years ago.
Was it that long ago? And
yeah.
Now, actually, I posted...
Five or six.
I posted it on our Facebook page for the women's show that actually NPR was introduced by, I believe, Judy Woodruff. They did a study of it, and some of the women firefighters they talked to, we had on the show. And I think it was absolutely chilling, you know. And so when I read about you and what was happening, and I realized that you were under a real problem because you really couldn't talk out, you know, with a lawsuit and all that pending, et cetera. But having followed so many, whether it was soldiers or whether it was those firefighters, et cetera, and the vicious thing, it was the retaliation in a way that I don't think most of us can even think about, that first of all, from the get-go, they suffered, you know, usually sexual advances or, you know, undue requirements, et cetera. And as this one woman who actually is, and now I think she has retired, but she didn't speak out because she realized that if she did, she would get such retaliation, and she was near retirement, and she'd have to resign. And I think that it was really interesting when she was going through, and this was a tough, really capable, you know, she's one of these people that jump out of planes and fight fires, that kind of stuff. I mean, she's the real deal. She was saying that when, you know, she became the firefighter, that she came actually from a military background. And she's like you. She's in top shape. She's tough. She's smart. And here this woman actually at that time was risen to the highest level. And she said she was stunned when she first went in. From the get-go, her superior, you know, was making unsexual advances. And when she said, forget it, and that's not going to happen, she started to be retaliated in all different kinds of ways. And so finally she thought, this isn't going to work. So she tried to come into a middle ground. And she said, little did I know that the request would escalate constantly. And so she said, you know, and she now is sorry she didn't speak out, you know, because she said, maybe I could have helped people. Yeah, it would have ruined my career. But she said, you know, that actually you could speak out and be public enemy number one, or you could constantly be putting up with perhaps escalating demands from you at your workplace.
Or both. So
yeah.
When you do speak out, you do become public enemy number one to your coworkers, to the administration, and then also to the public who doesn't hear all the sides, because you, most of the time, you can't speak out. I know for me, every time a complaint is brought up, or some, whether by me or somebody else, we are told that we are not allowed to talk about it until they close it, until they close the investigation, or you'll be fired. So a lot of the times you can't even discuss it. So it puts you in a predicament that, like, you can speak up, and it doesn't mean the harassment's gonna stop. It just means that you can't talk about it anymore, even if it continues.
And you sued the city, finally. It got so bad. And what were the grounds, actually, of the lawsuit?
Primarily what we won on is pregnancy discrimination. They pretty much pregnancy discrimination and then retaliation after I complained and filed. They fired me the next day. So, but, I mean, they haven't really changed since then. I mean, it was shown in the court of law, they did discriminate against me, and discrimination is against the city policy, and nobody's been disciplined for it. And I asked HR about it, and they said that they will not be disciplined for it. So,
and did they give any reason why they won't be disciplined in any way?
No. And the discrimination was in writing. They failed me on my evaluation. My the district chief failed my evaluation, citing that it was because I was pregnant. And the fire chief signed off on it. My captain signed off on it. And under the city's policy, any discrimination is supposed to be 15 days unpaid, you know, suspension up to termination. And I cited that to HR and they said that they would not be disciplined for it. So, I mean, that's the thing is when people do things that are against the rules and they're not disciplined for it and they bully and they harass and they are not only allowed to do it, but almost encouraged to do it, nothing changes. So, I mean, the city, after they lost the lawsuit back in last November, I mean, the city really had a opportunity to kind of give a self-evaluation and say, you know what, we did something wrong, we need to change. But instead, they just double down. They the judge forced them to let me go back, but they haven't made any changes at all. And if anything, I mean, their policies and their treatment has been almost, you know, worse.
Well, and, you know, you can go on YouTube or just, you know, do scans of papers. Just put in firefighters, harassment, et cetera. And it's across the board. I mean, you'll find it in Milwaukee. You find it in Austin, Texas. You just find it across the board. And, in fact, I put out a little clip that it isn't only for women that I was going to bring your attention to it. That actually, I just saw it in the Tampa Bay Times this week. Muslim firefighter settles with NYC, New York. Rahim Kassam sued in 2015. He was subjected to firehouse harassment over his faith and race, including being fed pork and in violation of his religious beliefs, settled for $224,000. The city did not admit wrongdoing.
And they won't admit it.
Because is that the case here, too? They did not admit any wrongdoing?
No, they won't admit it. I never got a city apology. There was the only people who ever said, I'm sorry for what you went through. There's been, I think, two or three of them so far since, like, pretty much the year I've been back. And they were all people of color who have experienced that sort of harassment, discrimination. I mean, I see it every day. I never had heard as many racial slurs as when I'm caught in the firehouse. And like the sort of negative attitude towards, you know, towards women and sexist attitude. Like I just didn't, I thought that it was, that it ended, I guess, a while ago. And I guess it was my, I guess I was shielded from that sort of attitude. But going into the fire department kind of opened my eyes that it's alive and well. And now since, you know, obviously 2016 with our president, the bullying is out in the open and encouraged.
And I'll continue here. Hassam said in a federal lawsuit he was subjected to a hostile work environment, included anti-black racial slurs and co-workers cooking food for community meals that included pork, but falsely telling him otherwise. He said he was retaliated against when he complained.
Yeah, I've had meat put in my food multiple times with them knowing that I don't eat meat.
Hassam said his client is working in a new firehouse. And you know that when you won your lawsuit, as I say, we've covered enough of these cases that, you know, whether it's the military, the Coast Guard, unfortunately, just almost across the board, there was no doubt in my mind that you were going to face a very tough environment when you went back. And I guess I'm really, you know, we're at a point, and, you know, that it's a cultural problem. And maybe it's just such a sense of this is how things are, this is how things work. I don't know, but you know that it doesn't do anybody good because not all men do this. This, you know, I would say in most organizations there are just a few predators.
Well, the problem I know with my experience is there really is only probably about 10% of the guys who are actively mean to me. But the problem is that other 90% don't speak up.
And are they afraid that if they speak up, they'll be retaliated against too?
From what I mean, so I've had some people come to me and say that. From men to be harassed, women who have been harassed, saying, yes, I see what happens to you. And if I'm in your side of the boat, it means I'm against them, so I can't. But then also, there's some people that just don't want to speak up just because, you know, they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want anything, you know, to happen to their career. And, I mean, it's been shown, again, that it will happen. So, I mean, a lot of the guys, they just won't speak up. And if anything, if it comes to telling the truth or lying in order to protect their career, they lie.
And again, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, and we've just been hearing Tanya Vidovich, the female firefighter extraordinaire, and we also have Lisa Perry in the studio with us. And, you know, Lisa and Tanya and Tess, you on the phone, jump in here. Because, you know, and I know Tarana Burke is very upset the way Me Too direction is going. I'm really curious to hear her speak when she comes here. And I think she's quite right. You know, that it's kind of become almost a celebrity fanfare kind of thing. And it's, you know, that it's almost, don't misunderstand me, I don't have any any pity for these perps, but it's almost a focus on them, who can be outed next. When, you know, that the women have suffered a great deal. And one of the reasons they don't come forward is because it still does, they feel, have an onus, and they're kind of looked at, well, what did you do? What, you know, you should have done something differently, et cetera. And I think we're at a point that it really is important that we figure out, how are we going to deal with this? Because here you've got the firefighters, and, you know, that I don't think it took 9/11 for most people to realize that they are so heroic. You know, and they are so essential to our society. And I think the first responders, you know, the fire rescue people that, you know, go to the medical emergencies that aren't necessarily a burning house, but, you know, a heart attack or a stroke or maybe a child has ingested something. You know, I mean, these are critical people in our society for it to work right. And I think it takes a certain type of person to want to do that because it's dangerous also. Particularly for fires with all the toxins and everything else, not just the flames you're exposed to, but you're exposed to everything. And is it a culture where, I mean, you're in that environment, Tanya, and I think there are good people that would go into that, and we need them to be good people. But I've also read about the problems that some of them in the fire rescue are having with alcohol and drugs. And so is there a stress involved with that job, but you can't be macho and say, I need some counseling or something here? I mean, what's happening?
Well, that's the case. You're expected to have this masculine, no emotion, suck it up type personality. But unfortunately, I mean, it's a hard job, and you see a lot of sad moments, and you are not allowed to get upset. For instance, like, I mean, there was, you know, a couple months ago when somebody messed with me and stuck this human-sized head that looked like me on a stick through my bag, and it was a broomstick, so it had a rounded edge, and it went through my bag hard enough to make a hole. I got upset. I took it as a threat, and I did cry for like probably about 5 minutes or so. I got upset, and then I stopped crying, and I made a complaint, and I was told that if I was going to make a police report, I had to go home. I was not allowed to make it, and so they tried to intimidate me not to do it. But afterwards, I was like, well, can I come back on, can I stay on duty after I'm done with the police report? And they said, no, they didn't want event. I forget exactly the words that they said, but they didn't want me to cry again. And that was the reason why they sent me home, because I got tearful. So you're not allowed to really have any emotion at all on the job. And it's a hard job. I mean, you see, you know, kids dying and abuse and these horrific accidents. And sometimes, like, so you're not allowed to have that human emotion that should be in all of us.
And, you know, there has to be, and I know this is the same kind of conditions we were told kind of prevail at the Coast Guard and other military installations. And I think it's maybe the housing kind of thing, that there is such a isolated area, so to speak, and they can feel in such control. And so, and one of the biggest problems, and I know it's true where you are too, that there is a definite chain of command. That you have to go to mm-hmm. report. And then, and unfortunately, at least for a lot of women in the military, some of the people that have been harassing them are literally their superiors, that they have to go through that chain of command.
Well, you know, it's funny because I actually, this past year, I have reported a lot of harassment, because before I took it, you know, I didn't report it, I just internalized it. And so this time I am reporting harassment that goes on. And this year in my evaluation, they came so close to failing me by one point. They passed me for my evaluation. But in my evaluation, they cited some of the reasons why I was marked down was reporting harassment. So literally they marked me down on my evaluation for reporting harassment. I mean, you're not supposed to do it.
And it wasn't a woman that was considered. I believe she testified in your trial. And she was actually passed over for a promotion, even though she was eminently qualified. And finally, after the third time it happened, and she went to the chief and said, "Why am I being passed over?" And he literally told her, "Well, we thought that you needed to stand up on the Vidovich situation."
Yeah, and she was not my supervisor. Women are judged more harshly. I mean, and... We just are. We're passed over for promotions. We're judged more harshly. I mean, and it does take a lot to stand up and say this is wrong, because you will get retaliated against or you won't get promoted to the next time. I mean, how are you supposed to continue with a positive attitude? It's very difficult. I try every day to come in with a smile and to come in with and do my best. But I mean, it's very hard.
And we just had a call from a listener who, first of all, wanted to express his empathy with all the firefighters, the women firefighters that get a lot of discrimination and harassment. But he said that his mother has worked for a fire department in the Northeast for 30 years.
Wow.
She's almost ready to retire.
Oh, my goodness.
And he said she never heard the kind of remarks that she heard there. She never had things directed at her any other place that has happened in the fire department.
And that's the thing, is that there's some women who may not get harassed, but just because it doesn't happen to you doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Yeah, it has to be this culture, and I repeat, unfortunately, I think that, you know, I remember when the terrible situation, I don't know if you people remember, at the Steubenville, Ohio, the horrible transgression of that little 16-year-old girl that they drugged, and they dragged her around and were assaulting her in all these different parties, and they very stupidly, or perhaps luckily for her, they took pictures of it and put it up on Facebook. And the police said, "Oh, you can't do that, you know." So they took it down, but it was too late. And you know, that then people were so horrified, because, you know, there were groups in different parties, and they stood there and watched this. And some said, because the three that were the perps mainly involved were brought to trial, and they said, "Well, why didn't you say something? Why didn't you help her? She was unconscious." And they said, "Well, you know, we didn't know what to do, et cetera." So I think it was a very good analysis, actually, that there's a spectrum of violence. And you know, that the end result is the horrible rape or the assault. But all the way along, and all of people who are bystanders, all of us, so to speak, one way or another, who don't speak out, who don't say something, that actually we're part of this whole spectrum of violence. And I think that's almost the way we have to look at it. And so I'm looking at your situation, or the women in the Air Force or in the Mercy Marines and all that kind of stuff, that it's a culture. And I think that's why it's so important, because I feel so bad for you, Tanya, because I think you are being nitpicked to death. No, I'm serious, because you really confronted them, you won, and you're as bad to them as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is to the old boy network in Washington.
Well, you know, and it's funny, too, because people filed a hostile work environment against me coming into work. And when you look, and I would read the hostile work environment cases, and mind you, these are people, I mean, I've been screamed at, my gear has been messed with, people dumped sludge on my bed linens, like, they have messed with me since being back. And all of the hostile work environment all filed within like 3 days of each other, so you think that that wasn't... you know, they were collaborating, obviously, to do this, to try to get me out of the station. But they were all just saying that me being there stressed them out. And that is it. So me merely being in the fire station is causing them enough stress that they say that I am causing a hostile work environment. So, like, they're literally trying to get me fired for just being there.
And didn't they even refer to the expression on your face as being one of the complaints?
Yes, that I had one of the complaints that went straight to the personnel chief was that my face had a mad demeanor that literally went there. That got me a... That got
well,
enough
let's see
to
a little
to
smile over there. You've got a lovely smile, incidentally. And Lisa, you're listening to this, and you're more the political activist that will support the candidate who would want to change situations like that.
Right.
Who would be alarmed at that. Probably might not be aware of it, but if he saw it happening under his watch, you would hope that he would do something, or she would do something about it. And so what do we do? Because you're such a great activist. You know, I mean, you really are.
Thank you.
No, I mean, you put your money in your mouth and where your actions are. So what do we do?
Well, you know, one thing that has been going through my mind while I've been listening to everything today is, and something that I've been examining for the past 2 years, is a lot of women that are not speaking out or are victims of this type of discrimination in other ways. And ironically, as progressive and whatever kind of activism I've been involved with over 2 years, I myself have experienced some different moments of discrimination and some things that I felt threatening. And then I spoke out and I was highly targeted, and it did come back and retaliate me, even in the activist world. And what I try to explain to a lot of people is that, you know, we'll see this big celebrity movement with the Me Too actions going on, but women like Tanya are living this every single day, like myself living this every single day. And one thing that I've been trying to work on is trying to figure out how to get out of just our circle of voter block of people who are engaged. And I've been looking at a lot of women in communities around me, curious as to, you know, how do you just go about your day, like waking up, your normal drop the kids off at school type of, or go to work or whatever it is, and you're not engaged, and how is it that I get them engaged? And I actually think that this is a really appropriate show right now, because honestly, my own experience of whether it is me standing up and being a voice for someone with an experience like that, or whether it is someone who is experiencing it themselves, I think that there is a cultural pressure. Not only, I think it's very, very amplified in a situation like the fire station, where there is it's almost under a microscope where you can see this happening. But I also think that it is still very cultural for all of us in the communities, in terms of giving women the power to speak up, to say this is unacceptable, to not be afraid to use their voice, because when you do, you become, you know, Alexandria Cortez, who's crazy, and
you're penalized. We're painted,
yeah, you're penalized very highly, and I've lost jobs over having said the voice. And sometimes when you do speak out and you say, you know, hey, this happened to me, all of the sudden you think you're going to have this huge support network around you, and you're just standing in a spotlight by yourself, and it can be very scary. And I've experienced that myself. Even just being an activist, sometimes I will go to like my children's schools, and you know, people don't make eye contact with me in the hallway because they're like, oh man, she's that crazy protester, you know. And how do you give people the voice? How do you give people the support? And I think it is bringing this to, we have to take this from this Hollywood ideal of, you know, Harvey Weinstein came in and attacked me, to realizing that these are everyday issues that are affecting our heroes, our mothers. Our mothers are heroes, you know, and a lot of women can't find their voice, and they don't have the support network when they need it. And I think what I've been trying to do is working on building some common ground coalitions within our communities now that will amplify everybody's experience in a more tangible and relatable way. What you are talking to me about in terms of you are a firefighter and this occurred to you here in Tampa, that is way more relatable than hearing about, you know, Reese Witherspoon out in Hollywood. So, and I just think we have to continue to be brave, but I also think we really need to focus on the support that is there for women who do want to use their voice, because as I've experienced it, and obviously you have, I know that once you do take that brave step, you are very much alone, and it's a scary place to be.
And we have to encourage both men and women to speak up when they see something happening. And that's one of the places where I think most of us fail.
And
we think, oh, I shouldn't get involved, or I don't want to add to the problem, or whatever the situation is, but you don't want to get in the center of it. And sometimes you have to.
I've brought that up to so many men on the job where they're like, you know, let's talk about what happened to you and tell me the story. And after I tell them, they're like, oh my gosh, I had no clue. And I'm like, yeah, you should be fighting for a pregnancy policy, you know, for the next meeting. You should be fighting for women's bathrooms, you know. And he's like, oh, no, that's a woman's issue. And I'm like, well, obviously they're not listening to women as far as it being an issue. So if, like, we need also actual man allies that are willing to stand up and say, you know what I mean? This is an issue. We need to make it happen. And then one thing I always bring up with guys that I end up talking to is when they're chosen over a woman or a person of color for a promotion or an opportunity for training or education, sit down and let somebody else take that opportunity. Because, like, for instance, I'm working with one of the firefighters right now who has less time on than I do, but has had the opportunity to a lot more training. So he is very disrespectful, you know, to me, because I haven't had the training that he has. And it's like, well, you know, there's a reason why you got trained more than I did, why you have this knowledge on how to work these very specific tools, is because I haven't had the opportunity, because I wasn't allowed to. So, I mean, having that...
And you weren't allowed to. I mean, there aren't certain mandatory trainings that everybody has to
there's
have.
Basic. There's basic training.
Oh, but these are
but then
extra.
There's extra. Yeah, there's extra training with different tools and opportunities. You know, opportunities to do things in the, I'm sure, in all aspects of jobs across the board where, you know, and so if there's somebody in line behind you and they have, it's probably likely that they have a less of an opportunity, sit down. Like, sit down and let somebody else, you know, have that opportunity as well. And that's something that doesn't really click in their head, that there's only so many spots at the table. And if you're taking one up, there's somebody else that doesn't get a chance.
And it becomes uncomfortable for people as well, right? So in the past 2 years, as I've worked with many women in the community, I've noticed over and over again, there's this theme of, I'm on the verge of divorce, or my husband and I are fighting about this, that, and the other. And it is because women are paying attention and they are using their voice and they are speaking up. And I believe that even though someone can have an amazing partner in a perfect little world at their home, all of a sudden something's changing, something's transferring. This woman is becoming powerful and using her voice, saying this is not acceptable, kind of breaking out of this mold. There's a transfer of power between how things used to be and women are kind of taking charge and taking leadership. We see that in the House. We see that in our activist lives. We see that in, like, our everyday heroes, the firefighters. And I think that it has been amazing to me to see so many men that you would think would be supportive of these types of issues, that would stand out, would speak up. And I've noticed oftentimes them getting angry, and it's almost threatening. I think that the environment is uncomfortable. Change is uncomfortable, and
criticism.
That
sort of critique that you give any man, and it's not even like, a lot of the times it's not even angry. Like, you did this wrong. It's like, this is a learning experience, and that sort of critique towards them, they get defensive. Like, you attacked them.
I think it's a changing. You know, it's the way that people have grown up. It's the culture that we've grown up in.
You said it. And not just the culture, it's the structure.
Yes.
You know, Gretchen Carlson, you know, written several books, and she was one of the first that came out. You know, like, Tanya was involved in her lawsuit long before Me Too was on the scene. Well, the same thing with Gretchen Carlson, and she's pursued it. And she realizes the sexual harassment in workplaces, or just the harassment in workplaces, is just endemic. And so she's continued. She not only wrote her book, and incidentally, I think one of the really interesting things, and the reason I mentioned structure, is because she said some of the worst aspects of this whole harassment in the workplace is, quote, the human resources. Because
yes.
She said, at the bottom line, they are part of the structure. And so it looks bad to them, or they think it does, and to their superior, if they don't deal with this complaint. So it's just better that complaint is just nullified and just dismissed as, you know, just a troublemaker. And I think it's getting down to the point, you know, that women are so aware that this structure that is our government, that is kind of the unwritten rules of our society, a structure, and it has privileged males. It has. And men don't even know it. And so now when women are there, and women are saying, hey, I can do this too, let me try it, that this is uncomfortable for everybody. So this is a real transformative structural change. And I think that it takes tremendous awareness, not only of a situation like a Tanya, but Alisa and Tess Martin. You just have to jump in here because I don't have eye contact with you. But we're changing the basic structure.
And I love the way that you said that, deal with like for HR to deal with, because I mean they don't treat it like it's a human getting harassed. They you're right, they treat it like it's a problem and you better get rid of it, which is usually just stomp you down.
Yep.
So I mean, and when I got when I was getting reinstated, I called for HR to be retrained and replaced, because the amount of people that called, which made them love me. So the amount of people that I get called from the city of Tampa that aren't even firefighters, but also some firefighters that said HR was the worst of the harassers. And so instead of retraining HR or replacing those HR representatives, instead, like, HR just now knows that I complained about them. And they will find any, I mean, they called me uncredible. I'm an uncredible person, to like pretty much untrustworthy. So, I mean, at that point, any sort of complaint that I bring up, they automatically dismiss it.
And, you know, many of you, I'm sure, remember that Mary talked with Jackie Spear last week. And, of course, she's been through some incredible circumstances, woman. But she's also had some enormous losses. And she was pointing out that one of the things that she learned is that when she has those losses, or when she's in a situation where she speaks up but she's uncomfortable doing it, she realizes that that's part of her growth to the next time around. And it's extremely important to do things like that.
And just in an ancillary thing, because I'm such a sports fan, you know, I kind of compare it to the professional athlete, whatever the sport, and, you know, the team has their own doctors. And athletes learn the hard way that a team doctor might have a different attitude to okaying a player to play for a really important game. And they've learned the hard way that they have to go to their own doctors to get a second evaluation, because the team might have a different interest than the best welfare of that particular person. And to me, it's kind of that kind of a situation that, you know, that I'm not blaming the people in HR. I understand that they're getting pressure from above, and that it's, if you refuse to see there's a problem, like here in Tampa, after you won your lawsuit, they had a problem. And they had a choice. They could have dealt with it constructively, saying we want more women in the fire department. We want this to be a good workplace for everybody, because we are so important to our community, and what we do here reflects our community. But instead, you can circle the wagons and say, this person is just an out troublemaker, a complainer, and all that kind of jazz. And that's the structure that is being challenged.
And you mentioned Gretchen Carlson, and she does have a series coming up on Lifetime Television, Breaking the Silence. And the first in that series, it's either three or four stories in which she's gone around the country and talked to women that have been harassed, people that have been in uncomfortable situations, etc., will be aired this Monday at 8 o'clock on Lifetime.
And guess what? One of them is a firefighter.
One
big of the
surprise.
Four women that she's initially emphasizing.
And one thing I wanted to point out is we talked about privilege and male privilege, and this isn't, you know, necessarily just a bunch of angry women sitting around trying to burn men down.
It's not.
It definitely isn't. And it's also, you know, creating a concept for people that are in a place of privilege, whether it is because of your race or your sex or whatever it is realizing the privilege is not, you're not a bad person because you have privilege, but accepting that you have privilege and then realizing how to elevate other people without that privilege. And I think that's something that's missing in the culture and structure as well.
Yeah, I think
one of the things that I've been hearing strongly from both of you is education, we all have to, it's not something that we have to depend on the schools to do, but we all have to get involved with educating the people we're around.
And Tess, I'm so sorry, I can hear you trying to say something. we don't have much time left, so you go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to agree with Lisa when she was talking about just layers of privilege, and I think that some of, going back to your original point with talking about kind of the disappointment of the Me Too movement, how it hasn't really trickled down from, you know, got a lot of attention because all of these high profile folks were coming forward and saying, look, I faced this sexual harassment and here's what happened to me, which was powerful. And I'm glad that national conversation has happened. But then you don't have it trickling down to the local layers. So you have something like in your local fire department, you have these issues happening. And when a woman steps forward, as Tanya has done, she's attacked by both women and men. So it's really important to see, like, to humanize these stories on more of a local level. And that's where I think the national conversation has kind of failed, in that it doesn't lift up these voices of women just, you know, doing these everyday non-Hollywood jobs that are facing these levels of harassment and even just microaggressions, things that you can't, it's hard to explain kind of the harassment that you're facing because it's so small and it's like a nitpick. It builds up. And those are the really hard incidents to explain.
And you are, go ahead, Arlene.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa. This has been From a Woman's Point of View. Support for WMNF comes from our members and Live Nation, presenting Nile Rodgers and Cheek live in concert at the Duke Energy Center for the Arts Mahaffey Theater, Friday, January 18th. Get more information at themahaffey.com. And you have been hearing Tanya Vidovic.